guys, and welcome back to another episode of BRF Shots on Us.
Hi.
So, the word for this episode is idiom. Now, we've picked our favorites.
Yeah.
And we're going to tell you about them.
Yeah, so basically we jumped in, picked a couple of idioms that we would have decided that this would interest us and we want to know more about it. And therefore, you must know more about it. And that's our interpretation of the word idioms. Enjoy.
Enjoy, captive audience. So, the first one is, everybody's heard of this phrase, having an Indian summer.
Yes. Isn't a book as well or something? A book or a movie or something?
Is it?
I feel like it is.
Oh, I think it might be. Yeah. I wonder which version or which meaning of the phrase Indian summer they were using. Because it is commonly misinterpreted. Even by me. By me, you guys.
Oh.
So, I interchangeably use it as, you know, a really hot spell that reminds me of summers back home in India. But an Indian summer, the literal definition is an unseasonably warm, dry and calm weather. But hold on, there's a stipulation. Usually following a period of colder weather or frost in the late autumn. So you're going around your business. Jeff's, you know, looking at the trees and he's like, oh, the beautiful autumn colors. And then suddenly you've got a week of dry, calm, hot weather. So that's what an Indian summer is called. The term Indian summer was actually from the US at the time. It reached England in the 19th century during the heyday of the British Raj. And that's how it was probably misinterpreted as Indian, as in from India, summer. But actually, it began in the US in the late 18th century. The early users of the expression weren't referring to any particular race, some would say. They were just using it as a definition of something exotic. So if you'd say, it's all Greek to me, something like that. So they'd use it interchangeably with exotic.
Oh.
Yeah. The first usage of the phrase, the recorded usage, is from a work in 1778 by a French-American soldier. He said, then a severe frost succeeds, which prepares it to receive the voluminous coat of snow, which is soon to follow, though it is often preceded by a short interval of smoke and mildness called the Indian summer. So you're expecting snow, but then you get like this hazy, smoky, hot weather. And the hazy part of the weather is usually due to the fires that the Native Americans would set post-harvest. So as a climactic event, it's known throughout the world and is technically called a weather singularity. But there are some names for it that the English already had. Some of them are St. Luke's summer, St. Martin's summer, All Hallows' summer, and the French also had a name for it, and it was called L'été de la St. Martin. The incidence of Indian summers has actually increased significantly over the past decade or so, because thank you, global warming.
Oh, wow. That took quite a turn.
Well, I'm sad I can't use it anymore, because I know what it means now.
Unless you actually have an Indian summer spell.
Yes, yeah. That's true. Yeah, every cloud.
Okay, so my phrase is, I want to know, how did we come up with the term raining cats and dogs? The first recorded use of a phrase similar to raining cats and dogs was in 1651 in a collection of poems by the British poet Henry Vaughan. He referred to a roof that was secure against dogs and cats rained in shower. A year later, the English playwright Richard Bourne wrote in his comedy City Wit, it shall rain dogs and polecats. For some reason, this seemed to have taken the fancy of the British public, even though there was no such phenomena recorded. But in 1738, Jonathan Swift published his complete collection of genteel and ingenious conversation, which was a satire on the conversation of the upper classes in the UK. And one of his characters fears that it will rain cats and dogs. Now, whether he eventually coined the phrase as we hear it today, or if he was just using a cliche, the satire became incredibly popular, and so the phrase sort of got common popularity. Other British writers have employed less popular phrases, like it's raining pitchforks or it's raining stair rods, just basically to describe pelting heavy rain with like the shaft-like appearance of heavy rain. That raining cats and dogs probably has the nicest ring to it, and so that just stuck around. Swift also wrote a poem called City Shower in 1710 that described floods that occurred after heavy rains. The floods left many dead animals in the streets, and that may have led locals to describing the weather as raining cats and dogs.
Mm.
But there are other interpretations of this. One is that Odin, who's the Norse god of storms, was often pictured with dogs and wolves, which were symbols of the wind, and witches This is my favorite part, by the way. Witches who supposedly rode their brooms during the storms were often pictured with black cats. So if it were raining really heavily, Odin was probably likely to blame. And then all the witches who were riding around, you know, in the sky with their cats hanging up their broomsticks probably lost their cats. And so you had dogs and cats raining down. There are also multiple other words that have been broken down into meaning cats and dogs, or just like in common colloquial English use could become cats and dogs, which have contributed to this phrase. There is a false theory that apparently one of the reasons why this phrase came into common use was because dogs and cats would hide in thatch roofs during heavy rain, and then just to keep warm and to sort of protect themselves. And then when it rained and it would be super heavy, they would come down in the deluge. But that is unlikely.
Oh, that's actually the one that I've heard.
Yeah, that's the one that I heard as well. Apparently it's false, but just an unlikely place for an animal to hang out because it's not comfortable for them. So this led me to believing that if it's not actually rained cats and dogs at any point of time in the history of the world, have there been other animals that have rained out of the sky? And turns out they have. So apparently, frog rain is a thing.
I've heard of this.
Yeah. I'm assuming not pleasant for the people encountering it.
Yeah.
So thankfully, not very common as a weather phenomena in the world, but although not as rare as we might believe, it happens all over the world, and at least since the 1st century AD, when it was first recorded by the Roman naturalist known as Pliny the Elder, and as recently as 2005 in Serbia. So on for a while. What ends up happening here is that because of heavy rain, there is a vortex that can form over water bodies. Now, similar to a vortex on land where you take smaller things like Dorothy's house and transport it to Oz. But in this case, it picks up smaller creatures from the water. So frogs, fish, snails, etc., etc. Now, I don't know why frog rain has become the most popular. I'm assuming there is conjecture to the fact that because of its reference in the Exodus, it's just sort of caught public imagination. But apparently, once the storm settles, you could have a rain of fish, snails, frogs, and other lovely cargo that has come from water bodies, usually dead.
Otherwise known as stay-at-home season.
Yeah, I think that would be to everybody's benefit. We don't know. Usually the frogs end up dead, and we don't know whether that happens in the while they're in the vortex or when they've been dropped to the ground from a height. However, in the frog rain that occurred in Serbia in 2005, people walked outside after the storm to see their streets blanketed in frogs trying to hop their way back to the water. So I'm not sure if that's pleasant or not. I guess it's the better end to what could be expected.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than having a choice between dying in a vortex or dying on the way down or dying on impact.
Well, I meant like just having to walk into a street full of dead frogs or like live frogs jumping their way back.
Yay, choices.
So that is the wonderful history of raining cats and dogs. And since it doesn't actually rain cats and dogs, other animals that you could possibly encounter during a heavy rain. But I sincerely hope you don't.
Never going to Serbia. Actually, I did want to go to Serbia, but not anymore.
Avoid the rains.
So, Ragini, you're super cute, you know.
Yeah. I have a feeling there's something, there's some kind of a request coming at this point.
Well, actually, I'm just trying to butter you up.
Oh,
you know?
Is that your phrase?
Yeah, that's my phrase. Well, everybody knows what to butter someone up means. Just being super nice, extra nice with the intent of getting something in return. Where did it come from? Now, there's two theories, one which is boring and one which is fun. So I'll start with the boring one, which is that it's pretty literal. Usually people who were rich or aristocratic had people do stuff for them all the time. And one of those things that they probably had done for them was buttering their bread. It was also quite a rich person thing at the time to have butter, because butter was a sign of opulence. So if someone was buttering your bread, there was obviously that aspect of them being subservient to you and them, you know, doing it so that they could get paid, I'm assuming. So that's one way to explain the expression. But the more interesting one. So the setting is ancient India. Okay. Ghee is a form of clarified butter. And in most South Asian cultures, as well as Middle Eastern cooking, it's quite popular. And in Southeast Asian countries, it's also part of religious rituals and traditional medicine. So it's generally revered. In India, apparently, not confirmed, but fun. Huh. Just remember. In ancient India, it was common practice to spread small balls of ghee onto sculptures representing various deities at the time of worship. So this was an offering. It was intended to secure favors from them. And it might have originated as far back as 1600 BC.
Wow.
So, yeah, I personally have not heard of spreading ghee on idols of guts.
I mean, I know you can you pour ghee on them, no?
Okay, so then that's checks out then, because Ragni is confirmed. Yeah. That does check out. There's also a practice in Tibet. Sometime between 600 and 900 AD, it started. Sculptures were made from butter. It was usually from yak butter. They're really intricate, these sculptures. Yeah, they're meant to be put on display for the gods to see how much they were worshipped. So it's not only India, it's sort of that general area. This long-winded story is all to say that if you were buttering someone up, you were likening them to God.
Oh.
And you were eventually wanting a favor from them.
Oh, wow. I did not know that. Yeah. I had no idea that the origin of this phrase would be somewhere in India. That was not a thought that would cross my mind.
I have to say, it's not fully proven, but it is the fun.
It is. Yes. Yeah, I think it sounds like a reasonable explanation as well. We should go with it. All right. And so with that, we are now taking a break for a week.
Yes.
But we will be back the week after with our regular programming all in place. So we will see you 2 weeks from now. Until then, I hope you enjoyed the episode. Listen to some of the longer episodes if you haven't yet. And we will see you next time.
See you.
Bye.